I have to start with an apology. It's probably always a good idea to start with an apology. So, I was in a different admin mindset, administrative mindset, until basically last week. And so, I didn't do all the last minute arrangements here. And apparently, over here, the administration is right now busy with two other bigger events that are happening along with us. So we're not their top priority either. And so we're a bit disorganized at the beginning. If only the confusion about the time, where I told people we start at 9:30, but the schedule actually says 9, and in the following days it will be 9. Okay? But I hope we will catch up and be sufficiently well organized throughout. But maybe that's not the most important thing, because this isn't a conference, it's a workshop. And the idea is that people will interact with each other and spend a lot of time with each other doing their own work. Maybe the disorganization will just add a little bit of spice rather than damage. I hope so. Okay, the most important things are on the blackboard. So there is a coffee break at 10:30, and you can get coffee pods at the end of the corridor that way. And then there is also a coffee machine there. I tested it, it works. Less important, so people who are here on a Simon's Fellowship of one kind or another should talk to Sakina Ben-Ima, and everybody else should fill out the refund form and give it to Louis Pelletier. And of course, the talks are at this time, but large stretches of this period, the talks will only be a small subset of that, okay? So we will have a lot of time to talk to each other. Okay, the next apology is that, well, okay, speakers, sorry, organizers are not supposed to speak, and I decided to speak, but then I decided to speak on ancient stuff. So really, I want to talk only about things that I more or less knew 25 years ago, and other people knew even longer. It's partially to bring everybody to more or less the same square. And have a common language and initiate a conversation and what's not. But then when I look at the actual people who are here rather than the people who are yet to come and could have benefited it, I see that maybe I'm insulting the audience. And I really hope I am not. So I want to talk like for an hour on finite type invariants as they were 25 years ago. And then that would lead me into expansions for various other algebraic structures as I understood them 10 years ago, but as other people understood them 50 years ago. So, I mean, this is still ancient history. And the Grothendieck-Tarnower group as of 25 years ago or so. And then I want to say something about virtual knots and welded knots as they were 10 years ago. Should I skip any of that? Is this an insult to anybody? If it's an insult, raise your hand. Gwonel, come on. Somebody should raise his hand. It's an insult. I'm insulting you. You should say something. No. Okay. Well, I'll do as I planned, and please forgive me. I don't know. I'm still hoping for a space in heaven, and my chances are less and less. Okay. I'll do finite type invariants maybe quickly, but maybe too slowly. I don't know. You should pace me, okay? So I want to tell you about, well, okay, the theme is, in a way, things, so invariants that behave as if they were polynomials on the objects in which they are defined. And much of it will repeat. I'll start with the sort of loveliest example in my mind, which is knots, but much of it will repeat in other contexts as well. So suppose you have an invariant V, which is valued on knots, sorry, which takes values on knots. So let me, K means the knottings of. The thing being knotted is a circle. So this is the set of all knots. It includes things like the trefoil knot and other things. And the circle is oriented, so the knots are directed, and without and everything is always is happening in an oriented copy of R3. So suppose you have an invariant of such things with values in some abelian group, and you know, this could be the rational numbers, or it could be polynomials, or it could be matrices, something where addition makes sense. Now, whenever you have such a thing, you can extend it to knots that have a singular point by declaring that if you have a knot with a singular point, you define V of that knot to be V of the knot which you get by resolving the singular point to an overcrossing minus what you get when you resolve the singular point to a double point, to an undercrossing, sorry. Okay? And that's why I needed an abelian group, so that this would make sense. Now, you want to think of differences, so these are differences of the value of the invariant on two knots which are neighboring to each other. So you want to think of differences as if they are cousins of derivatives. So you think of it as a derivative, and in fact, maybe a better notation would have been to call it V prime, so it's the derivative of the knot, of the original invariant. But instead of calling it V prime, the fact that I'm evaluating it on a knot with a double point means that it's V prime. Okay? And but then I can take second derivatives. So I can define V, in fact I can take the mth derivative, and V up M would be defined on knots that have M double points by either resolving the last one to an overcrossing and an undercrossing, or a minus an undercrossing, and evaluating Vm minus 1 on whatever you get, which will have m minus 1 double points, or resolving all of them at once, so you'll just be writing, this is the sum over all 2 to the power m resolutions of plus or minus V evaluated on the resolution, and I will not tell you the sign rule, but it's easy to figure out. The moment you have derivatives, you can define polynomials. So V is a polynomial of degree M if and only if the m plus first derivative of V is identically zero. So this is the analogy with ordinary polynomials in Rn, except we turn it into a formal definition and give it a name, and now the definition is V such as above is called Vasiliev of time M, or simply finite type of type M, well, I'll skip the words, if whenever you evaluate V on M plus, on a knot that has M plus one or more double points, you get zero. Okay? So, I guess already I can state the first open problem, and the biggest perhaps open problem of this topic. So, you see, on Rn, polynomials are dense in the set of all functions, of all smooth functions, at least if you use the appropriate topology. So if you wanted to look at the analogous property for knots, well, you could look at the first trillion knots and ask yourself whether every knot invariant can be approximated on the first trillion knots by a finite type invariant. Namely, given an invariant, an invariant which is given in an a priori way, can you find a finite type invariant which approximates it well on the first trillion knots? And if you think about it, this is true if and only if, so this very familiar property of polynomials is true in the case of knots, if and only if if and only if finite type invariants simply separate knots. So hence the first conjecture. So conjecture or open problem, do finite type invariants separate knots? So this is an open problem, but it has analogies in many of the other topics that we will talk about today in this workshop. Yeah.
So just to understand how it works, right? If you take so separate knots, so one would need to find say for two knots which are different, right? And invariant which has different values.
Yeah, which is zero on one and one on the other.
Right. So, but then if you choose any two knots, right? For each of them there would be some minimum number of intersections in the diagram, and the other one as well, right? So there is some minimum. So you can say that you limit yourself to some number of intersections in the knot diagram, right?
Yes.
And then so basically this is in some way, after that it's a finite dimensional problem or a family of finite dimensional problems. Oh, problem wrong somewhere.
No,
okay,
well,
so why
it
why
is not.
Well, why is
because,
it not true?
Because well, I mean, sooner we reduce it to a finite dimensional problem,
yes,
but not the finite dimensional problem you have in mind.
Okay.
Right, because basically every finite type invariant has to be defined on knots with all numbers of crossings.
Sure.
Okay, so I mean, if you manage to define your invariant on knots with 50 crossings, so that it would satisfy this property, it doesn't mean that it extends to knots with a million crossings.
Okay,
so as it satisfies this property. So it's not it's not yet a finite dimensional problem. It's not obviously a finite dimensional problem.
Mm. So you say if you restrict to knots up to some number of crossings in a knot diagram, then it is kind of obvious, right? Then, well, by definition, the dual of it are invariants, they are of finite type, and so they separate up to that number of crossings, right? Or maybe
no, because the condition, so.
Mm-hmm.
Not every function on knot diagrams is an invariant.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It also has to, for example, satisfy the Rademeister moves.
Mm-hmm.
So potentially it could be that there it could be that there will be very, very, very few finite tiling variants. A priori, it could be that there are none. Okay, because maybe satisfying this condition and being invariant under Eigenmeister moves is not compatible. I mean, it is compatible. There are finite type invariants, but it's not so simple. It's not a priori obvious. And in fact, the same question can be asked in different contexts. And you could ask the same question about welded knots or W knots, which really represents some sort of knotted tubes in four dimensions or something. And superficially, it's exactly the same question. And the answer is no. The conjecture is false. And you can ask the same question about braids. And again, the exact same definitions make sense. And superficially, the question is the same question. But the answer is yes.
But can you show later on examples of those positive and negative in the third talk?
If you will push me, I will.
Maybe the origin of my question is as follows. I recall vaguely that right in this universal finite type invariant, there at some point wasn't there some calculation of the dimensions or something?
Yeah.
And then this calculation of the dimensions, what kind of dimensions does it?
We'll get there.
Okay.
Okay. But to answer, but will I show it or will I not show it depends a lot on where you will push me. I mean, I want to be pushed more than I want to push. Okay?
That would be nice to see. Yes,
okay.
Let's start pushing.
Okay, I'll say it in one words, okay? Or in a few words, okay? Mm-hmm. So basically for... W knots. No. Now you're pushing me to 10 years ago. This is somehow unfair. But still, for W knots, the only finite type invariants are somehow all relatives to the Alexander polynomial, and Alexander polynomial is rather weak. And on the other hand, ordinary knots embed into W knots. And so you obviously can separate W knots because you can't even separate the ordinary knots that map in there. And on the other hand, for braids, so braids have a very, very, very simple structure theory. You can comb braids, and you can use it to show very quickly that you can separate braids. Basically, that's the... Okay? Anyway, so... thank you, Anton, for pushing me around, and let me continue insulting you with old stuff. So first of all, maybe there aren't finite type invariants, but there are, okay? And maybe the most famous example is the following. So there is something called the Jones polynomial, and the Jones polynomial is defined by the recursion relation Q times the Jones polynomial of an overcrossing minus Q inverse times the Jones polynomial of an undercrossing is equal to, God, what is it, Q to the 1/2 minus Q to the minus 1/2 times the Jones polynomial of a knot, of the knot that you get by replacing this little local picture with this local picture, okay? And the little theorem is that if you set Q to be e to the x and rewrite the Jones polynomial as a power series in x, so you write the Jones polynomial of k as a sum of jm k times x to the m, then, well, the Jones polynomial as a whole is not a finite type invariant. The question makes sense, by the way, because the values are in polynomials, and polynomials make an abelian group. But the Jones polynomial as a whole is not a finite type invariant, yet each J sub m is. So Jm is of type m. Okay? And so so finite type invariants are at least as powerful as the Jones polynomial, and in a similar way you can show that they are, that it is at least as that finite type invariants are at least as powerful as all quantum invariants taken together. So the Homfli polynomial, the Kaufman polynomial, whatever, the polynomials coming from bizarre representation of E8, representations of E8, all of them are found finite type. So I'm not going to fully prove it because, well, this would be too much of an insult, but I'll show it very, very, very briefly. So if you expand it as a power series in X, then, in X where Q is equal to e to the X, then the relation written here is 1 plus X plus X squared over 2 plus so on times J of an overcrossing minus 1 minus x plus x squared over 2 plus so on times j of n undercrossing is equal to, so if you look at this difference, it comes out to be x plus higher or order terms times j of a smoothing. And you can rearrange it, so basically you can move all the terms proportional to x and higher from here and from here to the other side, and you're left with j of an overcrossing minus j of an undercrossing is equal to, so everything that I've moved to the right had a coefficient of x in it, plus there was stuff on the right that already had x's in it. So basically on the right you only get x times a mess. Well, I mean it's a controllable mess, but for now I'll just call it a mess. But you see, the thing on the left is simply j of a double point. And then you can do this, you can iterate this procedure over m plus 1 tokens, and you'll find that j of a knot with m plus 1 crossings can be rewritten as x to the power m plus 1 times an even bigger mess. Again, it's completely controllable, this bigger mess, but it doesn't matter for this for now, okay? And so if you look at the coefficient of j to the of x to the m, so if you look at j sub m, it will be zero because here everything gets multiplied by x to the m plus 1. So in other words, if you look at jm evaluated on a knot with more than m double points, you'll get zero, and that's the end of the proof. Okay. So there are lots of finite type invariants, and then the next question is, can we find all of them? Okay? So to find all of them, the trick is to continue the analogy with polynomials. So basically, if the m plus first derivative is equal to zero, then the mth derivative is a constant. Okay? So suppose v is of type m, then if you evaluate v on a knot that has precisely m double points, then I claim that in some sense this is a constant. In what sense? In the sense that if you had here an extra crossing and it was an overcrossing, and then you compare the value of v on this with what you get when you replace this extra crossing with an undercrossing, well, the difference will, by definition, is v evaluated on a knot with m plus 1 double points, which is equal to 0. So, once you have m crossings, switching crossings does not change the value of the invariant. Okay? So, v is constant on classes of m singular knots. So an m singular knot is simply a knot which has m double points. So basically a knot like the one appearing here. So it is constant on classes of m singular knots relative to crossing changes. If you make a crossing change, the invariant doesn't change. But what remains? What are, if you have an m singular knot and and you are allowed to change crossings, then what remains depends only on the underlying combinatorics and not on the topology, not on how things are embedded. So let me make it more precise. So suppose you have an m singular knot. So let's draw one. So I took the trefoil knot and I made two of the crossings double points. And I suppose here is another one. Okay? So, and suppose I evaluate a type 2 invariant on either one of these, then the values of the type 2 invariant will not change if I flip this crossing, or if I take a little, you know, make an even more complicated change, which can be obtained by doing crossing changes. However, there is something that I cannot do by crossing changes. Namely, so suppose you were a little bug walking along this knot. So if you are a bug walking along this knot, you go through the double points in the order. So let's temporarily label them 1 and 2. So you go through the double points in the order 1, 2, 1, 2. And no amount of crossing changes will change it into the order that you will get if you are a little bug walking along this knot, where you will see 1, 1, 2, 2. So this corresponds to 1, 2, 1, 2, this corresponds to 1, 1, 2, 2, and that's not the same. Now, the standard way of summarizing the bug view of the knot, of an n singular knot, is by a chord diagram. So what we do is we replace this knot by the parameter space, which is a circle, and on the parameter space we connect by a chord any pair of points that are identified in the image, that become the same double point in the image. So for this knot, the so-called chord diagram is this, and for this knot, the so-called chord diagram is that. Okay? And The moral is that given any finite type invariant V, so if V is of type M, we get an induced map, which I will call W sub V, which is a map from the space of chord diagrams of which have M chords into the underlying the target space. Okay? And let's just be clear, DM is the space of chord diagrams, so things that look like a circle with M chords marked. Okay? And again, the way it works is if you have a chord diagram, you find a knot with m singular points whose combinatorics is dictated by the chord diagram. You evaluate the mth derivative of V on that m singular knot. The result is independent of which m singular knot you've chosen, and is the value of W sub V. Okay? And maybe I'll do one little minor change. It's convenient to allow rational linear combinations, or I suppose if this is a general abelian group, then you have to restrict your attention to integer linear combinations, and then extend WV linearly. Okay? So we've already proven that, or proven modulo missing details, but we've already proven that in every, if you look at type M invariants, if you fix the type, there are at most finitely many invariants of that type. Okay? Why? Basically because if you have type M invariants, if you have a type M invariant, then its nth derivative is determined by its values on M chord diagrams, and there are only finitely many of these, so there is only a finite dimensional space where the nth derivatives can take place, can take values. And if you have two invariants that have this invariants that have the same nth derivatives, then the difference between them has a zero nth derivative, which means the difference is of type m minus 1, and invariants of type m minus 1 we've studied yesterday by induction, and we know that there are only finitely many of them, or a finite dimensional space of them. Okay? So the space of finite type invariant is finite dimensional. Okay? We still don't know, we do know that they exist because of the previous argument, but this in itself is not enough to show that they exist, only to bound how many there are. Okay. So next, you can ask yourself whether every finite type, whether every functional on DM comes from a finite type invariant, and the answer is no. So, claim, theorem, proposition, W sub V satisfies the following two properties. So W sub V vanishes on the following two types on the following two types of things. So first type of thing is if you have a chord diagram that has an isolated chord. So it may have lots of chords like that, but it has one chord that doesn't intersect anything else. So this is a chord that intersects no other chords. So if you have such a chord diagram, then W sub V vanishes on it. And the second property is the so-called four-term relation. And the four-term relation is slightly more difficult to write. And it goes as follows. So basically, you draw four circles, and you say the difference of these two is equal to the difference of that two. You add a chord in the same position in all four. You choose a point which is the same point in all four cases. And you add an extra chord which goes from here to right before this cross, to right before the beginning of this chord, and then to right after the beginning of this chord, and then to right before the end of that chord, and then to right after the end of that chord. So now I got four chord diagrams. And in fact, I don't mind if there were additional chords in all four pictures here, but these additional chords would have to be exactly the same. So the four pictures differ only in the white chords. So the claim is that W sub V evaluated on the left-hand side is equal to W sub V evaluated on the right-hand side, and this is the four-term relation. So proofs. Am I insulting you? I'm still asking. Should I prove or should I skip or? What?
No, go very well. Yeah, it's
proof.
Yeah.
Okay, good. So proof of one. Proof of one. So this is very easy. If you have an isolated chord, you can represent it. So W sub V on a chord diagram that has an isolated chord is equal to the original invariant evaluated on a knot whose structure of singularities is dictated by this chord diagram. So it might have lots of singularities, but in particular, one of the singularities can be drawn like this. Okay? So basically a kink, which means squashed to have a double point. But you see, V of that is equal to V of this minus V of, so I've resolved it to an overcrossing, minus resolved it to an undercrossing, which would be this. And since these two knots are the same, the result is equal to zero. And I should say that this relation is, so the way I set up the theory, this relation holds. Okay, but it's actually usually a lot better to talk about framed knots. So instead of talking about sort of strings that are knotted, you talk about little ribbons that are knotted. So things like this. And if a ribbon has a kink and you try to undo it, you get a twist in the ribbon, and the twist goes in different ways depending on which way the kink went. And so if you're talking about framed knots, then this relation is actually not satisfied. So this relation, which we have just proven, is omitted if we are working with so-called framed knots, so knots that are simply knotted ribbons. And hence often this relation is called the framing independence relation. So it's the relation that says that we're not working with framed knots. Okay? And the proof of two is more fun. So take a knot which looks like that. So it has one special double point here. It has m minus 2 double points elsewhere, and I don't care where. And it has a piece of string that goes around the double point and below it, sort of, and below the picture, and lassos it and comes back. Okay? So suppose now you compute v of this, then, well, I can pull the lasso out and push it back in. And so the result, I mean, this is topologically the same as the knot that you get by passing the lasso above everything. Right? Because both of these are actually, because in both cases you can simply pull the lasso out and you get the same thing. So V of this is equal to V of that. But this means that the difference, so V of this minus V of that, is equal to zero. But you could also compute the difference in another way. I mean, instead of, well, the other way to compute the difference is to flip this crossing, then flip this crossing, then flip this crossing, then flip this crossing. So this difference is also the result of flipping four crossings. Now, each time you flip a crossing, the difference, the change, is the difference between an overcrossing and an undercrossing, and we already have one double point here and m minus two double points here, so this difference will make it exactly m double points. So the difference will be v evaluated on a knot with m double points, which is v evaluated on a core diagram. So the conclusion is that the sum of w of v evaluated on four different core diagrams is equal to zero. And when you look at it, it's exactly this four. Okay? So that, is this okay? Good. You know, it's funny because on the one hand, this is material which is 25 years ago. On the other hand, I haven't said these things in 10 years myself. No, not 10 years, but I haven't said them in a long time. So it's really funny for me to speak about them. Okay. But anyway, the conclusion is the following. So let's define a new space, A, calligraphic A, B, well, calligraphic A will be really a direct sum or even a complete direct sum of A sub M, where A sub M is D sub M, so the space of diagrams, modulo the four-term relations. And you know, if you complain, if you want to complain that I've kind of ignored the framing independence relation, it's because I really do want to ignore the framing independence relation. And if I wanted to unignore it, I would look at A reduced, which will be mod this further by the framing independence relation. So it's A modulo the framing independence relation. And what we have found is that W sub V, so if V is a finite type invariant, so if V is of type M, then the weight system of V, W sub V, is when it's a linear function along Dm, which satisfies the Fortier relation, so it becomes a linear function of A on Am. You can extend it by zero to the rest of A, so you get W sub V defined on A with values on in the abelian group, but it's of degree, but since it's supported on the m summand, is of degree m. Okay? And now comes the so-called fundamental theorem. So the fundamental theorem of this topic, of finite type invariant, says that this is the only condition that W sub V has to satisfy. Namely, if you have any W which belongs to the dual of A and is of some fixed degree M, then there exists a type M invariant V such that W is equal to W sub V, and you know, to be precise, I have to say a type M invariant of framed knots in the case where you're talking about A, and if you want to rephrase the theorem with A reduced, then simply ordinary knots. Okay? So the talk bifurcates now. Now we could run two parallel sessions. Or you know what? Even before the parallel sessions. So Anton, this is now fully computable. Right? These are finite dimensional space. So in each fixed degree, these are finite dimensional spaces with finitely many relations. And once you have the fundamental theorem, you know that this is all that is needed. And so you can actually easily compute how many finite type invariants are there in each degree, up to, you know, up until your computer runs out of power. And it, you know, your computer runs out of power at roughly degree 12, where you get a few hundred invariants.
But how is it, just to get back to the previous discussion, so this fundamental theorem, is it like a difficult or is it an easy theorem, right? Because before you were explaining to us that, well, I mean, to evaluate on some number of crossings is not enough, I should then, well, yes, see
so,
that it's...
So it's an extremely difficult theorem, mm-hmm. in the sense that the proof is transcendental, right? You can stare at it for a month, and you'll have no clue what to do, and then the proofs come from completely different parts of mathematics. Okay? Now, it's not very difficult in the sense that, you know, if you already know the proof, verifying that the proof is correct is half an hour, or an hour, I don't know, whatever. But in some sense, it's a very, very, very difficult proof. Okay? Anyway, the talk bifurcates into two directions now. So one direction is I could tell you how to prove this theorem, and the other direction is I can tell you why this space A is in itself very, very significant. Okay? I'm not sure which way to go. Maybe I'll say a word about how to prove this theorem. Okay? And then I'll run out of time because we started half an hour late because I'm an idiot. And then we'll push the other direction to the next talk.
So now you have to turn to real or rational positions.
To what? Oh, sorry, you're right. This is over Q. So So all of this is over Q, and over Z, it's still an open problem. Just to show Anton how hard it is, okay? It's actually not known over Z. Okay. So, how does the proof go? So, by soft arguments, soft, I mean things that you could do yourself in half an hour or maybe 2 hours, but wouldn't require something transcendental. Okay? So by soft arguments, the fundamental theorem is true if and only if there exists the following things. There exists the following thing. So there exists a universal finite type invariant, or alternatively a USTI, or the name that I now prefer to use, an expansion. And what is an expansion? An expansion is a map Z defined on the space of knots of, well, of knottings of a circle with values in our target space A. So, you know, maybe now I've switched to frame things, so maybe I'll call it framed knottings of a circle. So with values in this space A of a circle, so chord diagrams drawn on a circle, which has the following property. So if you compute Z on an n singular knot, so if you compute Z on K, and K is n, or m, sorry, I use m, so a knot with m singular points, then the result is, so, you know, Z should be some huge, infinite linear combination. I mean, I've allowed to complete this space. So it would be an infinite linear combination of chord diagrams, but what I want it to be is that the lowest order term will be the diagram underlying the knot K. So this is the chord diagram underlying K, and then maybe higher order terms. Okay? So why is this true? So I'll give half the proof. So suppose you had such a Z. Okay? So suppose you had a Z going from K to A. Okay? And suppose I wanted to prove the fundamental theorem. The fundamental theorem starts with, if there is a W, then you can find an invariant phi. So suppose I also had a W. So W was a weight system, was something defined on A with values in some abelian group. Well, you can compose the two. And if you compose the two, you get an invariant V on defined on K with values on A. And you can check that the condition written here means that that if you differentiate this V m times, you get the W you started from. Okay? So that's half the proof, and the other half is basically the same. So if you know for each W how to obtain the corresponding V, then that fully defines it. Okay? So, right. So then the trick is to find expansions. And how do you find expansions? Well, there are three, at least three techniques. So, finding Z. So, I guess there are three techniques. The first one is the so-called the Kontsevich integral. So, I don't think I want to write it in full, and even if I wanted, I wouldn't have the time. But basically, if you have Z and you want to evaluate it on a knot, you draw the knot in R3 and you place chords on it, horizontal chords on it, in various places. But you actually make it geometric. So the placement of the chord, of the chords, depends on some continuous parameters. Okay? So this becomes, so then, depending on these continuous parameters, you write a big integral depending on these continuous parameters, and that big integral, so you know, over here in particular, I've drawn a chord diagram by placing these chords. So that big integral becomes the coefficient of the chord diagram, and then I sum over all possible ways of placing the chords. So it's basically an ansatz that you could not guess if you didn't have background from other places. Okay? And then you can check that this is really an integral, that this is really an invariant by basically differentiating under the integral. So basically you deform the knot and you differentiate the corresponding integrals, and then you use your master C of Stokes' theorem to show that the derivative on the right, that the invariant doesn't change. So I mean, it's completely transcendental to the basic subject we talk about, the original question. And you can sort of rather easily check this property, and so you're done. Okay. Technique number two is even harder, but goes along the same lines. So basically, you write the so-called Chern-Simons integral. So you write the integral over the space of all connections on R3 of e to the ik over 4 pi, the Chern-Simons form of the connection a wedge dA plus 2/3 a cubed, multiplied by the holonomy along the knot k of the connection. This is an infinite dimensional path integral. You replace it by a sum over Feynman, so you do the whole game of perturbation theory. So you replace it by a big sum over Feynman diagrams of, again, integrals that depend, so basically integrals of expressions that depend on the diagram times the diagram itself. And again, the result is a much more complicated, but in some senses more beautiful, expression of the same kind. Okay? again, completely transcendental and works. And the third technique I'll talk about later, but that's associators. Okay, so there's supposed to be a coffee break one floor down at that end of the corridor. So it's time to stop. And
what the direct magical node?
Yes.
In direct magical, it is not just discuss the convergence issue. I say values of convergence or it actually is a holomorphic or some kind of that. So my question is that is there some convergence issue for this expansion? Say this expansion has some additional property such that the value of ED, coefficient of ED is not to grow fast or some kind
no,
of that?
No. Very simple answer. No.
No. Why?
So, for the purpose of proving the fundamental theorem, I need an expansion with values in A. A is degree completed. Okay? And I don't need any control of the growth rate of the coefficients or anything. I need this condition, the condition written here, but I don't need to know that the coefficients of the degree 7 of the degree m part grow slower than a power of than an exponential of m or something. I don't need anything like that. Yes.
But I guess if you want, you can ask that question.
Oh, of course, I can ask the question. The question makes sense. And there are places where the answer might be useful. But for the purpose of today, I don't need this.
Right, so it is kind of a formal expansion. So not as expansion as a convergent polynomial, but a formal power series like that.
Yeah. So it's basically everything is happening in the world of power series, formal power series. Yeah. Again, in other places, it could be, there are places where you want to control the growth rate, but not here. Okay? So, I'm going to have coffee.